You're listening to El Clásico, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España from Barcelona to Madrid. Today we're on the Collado de la Cruz.
You are indeed listening to El Clásico. My name is Daniel Freiber and I'm the host of this episode. And I am indeed in a very soggy Caravaca de la Cruz. I was going to say adjacent to, but I'm actually in the municipal shower block now where the entire Vuelta peloton is lathering up and talking down ahead of their short flight to Valladolid and the race's first rest day tomorrow. Meanwhile, joining me to discuss the day's action from his warm, dry, scented candle-adorned recording studio at an unknowable location in the United Kingdom, it is Lionel Burney. Lionel, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Daniel. How are you? Are you up to your knees in mud?
Not really, Lionel, because I didn't make it to the top of the mountain. Not many people, as far as the press are concerned, not many people made it up to the top today. There were a lot of journalists coming back to the press room sort of 20 minutes, half an hour after proudly, defiantly announcing that they were indeed going to the summit. They were coming back with their tails between their legs, having not made it very far. It's been a strange old day, Lionel. It's a strange, sort of seen some strange sights in the last 20 minutes or so. I said that I'm in a municipal shower block. It's actually more of a sports hall, and some of the riders, as is often the case before these rest days, before these transfers on rest days, they have commandeered, or some of the teams have commandeered, this sports centre and their changing facilities in particular. But what I have seen in the last 10 minutes is riders raiding the press buffet in a very unusual sort of parallel world role reversal. I've seen riders sampling the embutidos, the cured meats and the cheeses on display here. Also, Remco Evenepoel, he was just, had a towel around his neck, sort of in looking a bit like a boxer heading into the ring for round three against Primoz Roglic. He was actually heading out of the sports centre and towards the buses that are taking the riders to the airport in Murcia, I believe. A couple of the more sort of marginal gain-oriented teams have their buses still here, and they've been showering in the team buses. But municipal facilities for some others.
Interesting. I mean, the Vuelta's hot take machine has been overheating again today, hasn't it?
Because it's been muy caliente, hasn't it?
It's been muy caliente, yeah. I mean, I have to say, I'm going to talk about this from the perspective of a TV armchair spectator, cycling fan, sitting at home, having given up the hottest Sunday of the British summer to sit indoors and watch the cycling. It's absolutely scorching here, which bodes well for the rest of the week and my plans to get out on my bike before watching the Vuelta stages. But today was I'm actually pretty annoyed because it was a mess. It was an absolute mess of a stage. And this is an elite sport, and I don't want to just give the Vuelta a kicking, but there's almost nothing they can justify about the way the kind of results have been taken. I mean, I'm not saying that rider safety should be compromised, and I'm sure you'll be able to fill me in on all of the circumstances that led to today's rather unsatisfactory solution. But just it's nothing adds up at all. Not least the time gaps that seem to have been taken. You know, looking at pictures overhead, I went back and watched and looked at as best I could.
Do they not compute?
They do not compute. And I just think the sight of the riders, you know, getting to another invisible finish line, the GC riders this is, and then kind of just doing their warm down routine over the last couple of kilometres, they didn't really show at all the descent, which was supposed to be the most contentious thing. So we've got nothing to judge, really, the decision. And it's just frustrating. I know we have these incidents in Grand Tours every now and again. It happens at the Giro, it happens at the Tour. I mean, famously, the entire 2019 Tour de France was decided in a pretty unsatisfactory way when, a decision was arrived at that didn't really match up to the UCI rule book. But I suppose this is the flip side of the Vuelta organisers trying to find an interesting looking goat track up to nowhere, which is what it looked like, I guess. And it's worked plenty of times in the past, so perhaps I shouldn't be too harsh, but just, yeah, frustrating, a Sunday afternoon, an elite sporting event, and it didn't really look anything like that as far as I could see, really. Anyway, we should probably recap what actually did happen.
Yeah, we should. One thing I'll just say before in case I forget later on, I would say that the Vuelta organisers will benefit and have benefited already tonight, judging by the reactions of the riders, and some of which we'll hear. The benefit is from the fact that there are quite a lot of individuals and teams in this Vuelta a España who are pretty happy with status quo at the moment. They quite like the positions they're in. So it was quite difficult to find someone at the finish who was very aggrieved. Mm. And I think, you know, that says a lot about how nicely poised this Vuelta is after 1 week. And also some of the pretty phlegmatic, pretty kind of even-handed individuals involved. I'm thinking, you know, maybe about Primoz Roglic, for example. We're going to hear from Mateo Sobrero, who was second on the stage. He's a rider who might ordinarily have been kind of aggrieved, because everyone's sort of calculations were affected by what happened today. But there was a distinct lack of angst that I detected anyway.
Well,
but
the peloton,
talk more about that.
The peloton is risk averse, really. Obviously no one wants to lose the Vuelta or lose a stage win because the conditions are sketchy. But I do think, you know, we have gravelly finishes. We have the gravelly section at the top of La Planche des Belles Filles in the Tour de France. There have been plenty of gravel sections in the Giro and in the Vuelta. In the past, there have been ridiculously steep climbs. I can see the argument. No one wants to see the whole GC group skid out on the race to the line. But I said it before, you know, Grand Tours are outdoor sports, and if the roads are covered in mud, well, mate, I don't know what the answer is, but the difficulty is that this invisible finishing line, which was 50 metres short of the 2 kilometre to go banner, it meant that the commissaires were out with their clipboards and stopwatches again, trying to take the times for the GC. And it just gives the whole thing a bit of a kind of village fate feel, as far as I can see, really. And my vehemence about this is purely coming from the position of frustration that I spent all afternoon, 4 hours, while the sun was streaming through the blinds, watching a race that really was a non-event as far as the GC goes. And I don't mind a non-event as long as you know, it's not a farcical non-event, which this was.
Yeah, and you feel that it was, and you feel that it was justified. And it was difficult from the TV pictures to see why or how it was justified, because, as you said, we didn't really see the descent. I mean, I initially, when the decision was first announced, and 11 minutes later, I should add that it changed. Initially, it was 2.6 kilometers from the finish that it was going to be neutralized, and eventually, it was 2 kilometers. When we did learn that was going to be the case, my assumption was that those were very steep ramps to go up in the last 2 kilometers of the climb, and that maybe wheels would be slipping on the mud. It didn't really occur to me that the descent was the problem. I'm still not 100% sure. Wheel slipping, well, that was a problem, as we'll hear. Well, it was certainly, according to one rider, it was a problem, as we'll hear in just a moment. But I suppose we should crack on with the tale of the etapa.
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Well, yes, Daniel, the hot take machine. We don't really do hot takes on the Cycling Podcast, do we? Very rare. Straying into strident territory, and I apologise for that.
Stone cold, unmicrowavable takes.
Frozen in the middle takes, yeah. Well, it was stage 9, the last one before the rest day, to Caravaca de la Cruz, 184.5 kilometres. There was an 8-man break which had in it the eventual stage winner, Leonard Kemner of Bora Hansgrohe. He's completed the triple crown of winning stages in the Giro, Tour and Vuelta. He was joined by Mateo Sobrero, as you say, Daniel, second on the stage for Jayco Alula. Also in there, Chris Hamilton of DSM Emmanuel Gebregzabir of Lidl Trek, Jonathan Caicedo of EF Education, Ruben Fernandez of Cofidis, and Danny Navarro of BH Burgos, and Jon Baranechea of Caja Rural. Now, the other frustration was that there were echelons today, and I don't know what happened because we didn't really see when it was really kicking off and who was in which group. We were relying on sort of carrier pigeons to tell us what was going on.
I should interject, Lionel, that the Vuelta, if anyone wants to go on the Vuelta's official Twitter feed, there's a fantastic series of photos. There are four photos. I think it was Charlie Gomez that took those photos. And you can piece together quite well on the basis of those photos what exactly was happening. It looks very much as though Jumbo-Visma were forcing the pace. And, well, you can see there's one photo with Vingegaard on the front, another with Attila Valta, and you can sort of make out the rotation that was happening at that point.
I mean, I should kind of enjoy this this kind of plunge into the dark.
Great
as far
analog
as...
analog experience.
Yeah, it is very analog. Yeah. I mean, when you consider the Vuelta wasn't live on TV every day until 1983, I mean, this is like old school Vuelta. We should kind of glory in it, but I don't know. I think expectations have risen significantly in the last few years, and it is frustrating to know that some exciting stuff's happening and we can't see it.
It's a bit like trying to follow Arsenal Man United while podcasting in the middle of a podcast.
Oh dear. Anyway, the lead group approached the final climb. They still had around 5 minutes in hand over the chasing group, so they were going to fight out the stage win. There was a curious incident when Daniel Navarro punctured and went for a wheel change rather than a whole bike change, which certainly appeared to be a slower option. The first rider to open it up on the climb was Chris Hamilton. He tried an attack around 8 kilometres out, and then split the group down to 5 or 6 riders, and then Kemna made his move with 5 kilometres to go. Sobrero tried to go with him, but was chasing all the way to the line. Impressive from Kemna, who's won, where did he win in the Tour? 2020 Villard de Lans, wasn't it? And he won on Mount Etna at last year's Giro.
He's won in quite similar fashion. Yeah,
very
he's won
similar
in quite similar fashion.
Yeah, Lionel, this is his thing.
You were probably going to give us this stat anyway, but in case you weren't, I had a look earlier, and Leonard Kemna with this stage when he joins the elite club of, I think it's 107 riders who have won in all three major tours, won stages. 19 current riders, some really interesting names in there. I'll just run down that list quickly. So Kemna joined the club today. Cavendish, Roglic, Froome, Degenkolb, Ewan, Sam Bennett, Michael Matthews, Simon Yates, Magnus Kort, Elia Viviani, Nairo Mann, Matteo Trentin, Mads Pedersen, Thibaut Pinot, Thomas de Gendt, Matej Mohoric, Jon Izagirre, who's an interesting one, I thought, and Rigoberto Urán.
Interesting, yeah. As you said, Daniel, the times were taken 50 metres before the 2 kilometre to go banner, having originally, everyone was informed it was going to be taken at 2.6 kilometres to go. No idea what the reason for that change was or why they took the times at 50 metres before the 2 kilometre banner, presumably because it was just easier to stand by the side of the road there rather than right under the banner. Do you know?
I think that was something to do with the cameras. The photo finish camera had to be moved down from the top, and I believe that it was something to do with that.
From the GC group, João Almeida had a little go. He was joined by Alexander Vlasov briefly, and then Primoz Roglic opened up and, well, gained a little bit, probably, according to the results that we have in front of us right now. I mean, these results could be revised, could they, when they have a proper look at that video, I guess? I don't know. We don't know. Do you know?
It could be subject to VAR, funnily enough. Lionel's wagging his finger. Serendipitously, as we speak, Lionel. VAR is, well, it's very topical, isn't it?
Anyway, go on, Lionel. Yeah, there might be some small shuffling. It's very difficult looking at the result because, of course, the stage result is listed in order that they cross the line, but the time gaps are listed in the order they were taken just over 2 kilometres from the line. So it's as clear as the mud that was causing all the trouble in the first place. What we do know, though, is that Wout Poels is the big Casualty of the day, I guess he lost 17 places, slipped from fourth place overall down to 21st. Remco Evenepoel has jumped up a couple of places from sixth to fourth ahead of Mikel Landa. And, well, you know, it was a bit of a phony war. And as you say, Daniel, if there's no kind of complaints from the riders, well, perhaps after all of that, the commissaire just about got the call right in terms of the rider's safety and in terms of, you know, I suppose if it's going to be a farce, at least it's not a farce that's cost somebody, I don't know, 40 seconds or something ridiculous. It's been an inconsequential farce.
Yes, Lionel. I mean, imagine how Primoz Roglic in particular would have felt if, I don't know, Remco Evenepoel had dropped spectacularly, sort of 200-300 meters from the revised finish line, you know, and looked as though, well, for example, he bonked or was bonking. Didn't speak to too many direct sportifs at the finish, but, and I don't think, again, I think as it happened, luckily for the organisers, no one had based their tactics today on, you know, those last 2 kilometres, but that could have been the case. Lionel, you mentioned Chris Hamilton. Poor old Chris Hamilton, not only did he not get the stage win that he looked as though he was in good shape for at one point, he was sort of marooned. I mentioned this sports centre where I'm currently recording. He was marooned, looking sort of forlornly into the middle distance for about half an hour when he got back down here, because I don't think he had any clothes. There was some sort of miscommunication or some issue with DSM getting their riders some clothes, so he was left sort of standing around. He could have come and sampled the press buffet, enjoyed some of the other riders did, some of the other teams did. I won't name and shame.
Just with a towel wrapped around his waist, tucking into the ham and cheese. Wow, what an image!
He was still in kit, fortunately.
Oh,
yes. But Lionel, at this point, maybe we should hear from some of those riders who were conspicuously, well, not aggrieved after the finish today. One for good reason, I would say, Remco Evenepoel. We're also going to hear from Primoz Roglic, who, as I said, might ordinarily have been a bit upset. And we're going to hear as well from Mateo Sobrero, who, well, was the best of the rest behind Lenny Kemna and finished second on the stage.
Yeah, pretty good. Eh? Always in the front, together with Mattia, and in the end also with Seri. So never missed out the echelon. Made one ourselves, and then took control of the last climb till 1.5k to go in the end. So yeah, I think a good day for us. A bit of trouble with slipping on the last climb, which cost. I couldn't really do the sprint against Primoz, but I think overall very good day for us. Yeah, I think it's the right decision to be made, because already now at 5 kilometers an hour in the corner it was super slippery, like the left one. So I think it's a very good decision to just take put the finish line on top. Okay, it changed quite a lot in the race because the climb was like 5 minutes shorter, so that's quite a big time. And then I think, yeah, it's pretty new asphalt, I think, that's what I heard. So, yeah, you could feel it that it was new asphalt. For example, for myself, I couldn't attack out of the saddle, which is, which caused a few less watts in the attack. So, but I think, like I said, I think I lose maybe 1 or 2 seconds, so it's like nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a hard stage. Definitely, I just went from 0 kilometer. It was super windy. Then again and again, as cyclists, I mean, we can make it harder. Super hard day, after all. But on the last climb, I mean, was just smart decision because yeah, it was a lot of dirt and yeah, technical would be impossible probably really to finish on the place there where it was planned to be the finish. So a good decision good day we went through.
So you agree with the decision, even if perhaps you could have gained more time on Remco before the finish line?
For sure. I mean, the guys was there, did a great job, so happy to finish, and we go on.
Well, Matteo, how are you? You've had 20 minutes, half an hour to think about, well, coming very close. How are you feeling?
I did my best already today to make the break. It was not easy, like a good hard start, really stressed for the wind echelons, and once we take the climb, everybody was already a bit tired, and I could make the break, and then once in the break I start to think about how I can win, no? And of course, the guy that I look at was Kamna, because for me was the strongest, and in the end it was. And I couldn't close the gap when he attacked the last time, and I was really, really close for almost to the finish. And I think he did a really good performance, and I'm happy also with my second place. The shape is good, and it's good to finish the first week in this way.
And Matteo, the GC was neutralized with 2k to go. The GC was neutralized with 2k to go. Huh. What was on the road? What were the last 2 kilometers like? Were they dangerous? Was the mud on the road? Were there any problems?
Yeah, it was kind of mud. And also some rocks, so it was a new tarmac, but it was also a bit of gravel, no, from the new tarmac, and also it was a bit wet. It was not the best condition, but
it seemed a strange decision that they would neutralize it with 2k to go.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I was in the break, and for me, I don't know, I was just riding full gas, and so I didn't pay too much attention to that, but I just tried to don't crash and to do my best, yeah.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, Lionel, we're all feeling better now, aren't we?
we are. Can I just say one thing about my kind of downbeat, being very down on the Vuelta today? I think this really, for me, having been at races when there's been a kind of chaotic, kind of shambolic decision, a stage has been shortened, there's confusion and chaos. I mean, these are things, I suppose, are a part of Grand Tour racing. And when I've been there, there's a frisson of excitement. But I kind of appreciated today why there's so much sort of disappointment, irritation, particularly on social media, from people who are invested heavily in the race as spectators at home. There's a kind of a duty to explain better, really. Like, the commentators on TV are picking up snippets, you know, there's no reason given as to what, you know, just explain better what is actually happening and why. And obviously the riders need to know the decision that's made first and foremost, of course, but the TV spectators deserve to know as well, because otherwise no one really knows what they're watching. And I think that's a kind of fundamental fail from the sport as a whole. It hasn't really modernized quickly enough. You know, when you watch other sports and realize how light years ahead they are in terms of giving people a sort of 360 degree, sometimes, you know, to the point of distraction, you know, impression of what is going on in a given match or a given sporting event, cycling just feels like it's just, you know, stuck 15, 20 years ago still in some aspects. And I think TV spectators deserve a little bit better, because we're investing a lot of time in watching a Grand Tour.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Lionel. You know, it often depends on, you know, I described in the first part, the sort of municipal sports centre in which we're housed. It will depend on one journalist tracking down Javier Guillen behind the sort of bike sheds, as it were, and teasing out some kind of explanation. And there was a lot about today that we would like to know, and we don't know yet exactly what part of the road was dangerous. You know, I heard from Steve Cummings, the Ineos Grenadiers Direct Sportif, that
No, sorry, it wasn't Steve. It was someone else who told me that the issue was caused, or the fears were created, by a truck. I did actually see video of this, of a white truck that become stuck on the road, and at one stage the organisers thought they weren't going to get that out of the way. Others said that it was simply down to the how dangerous the descent was. We heard Primoz Roglic there say that he thought it would have been impossible to do the descent. Remco Evenepoel obviously, and you might say, well, he would say that, thought that it was the right decision. Yeah, tricky. I mean, going back to, from our point of view, selfish point of view as journalists, how it can, this all can be quite intriguing, quite appealing, the sort of farcical nature of Grand Tours. The other thing I love about Grand Tours is that you can sort of tease out the explanations over several days, I suppose. We probably will find out a bit more tomorrow. And, you know, there are so many moving parts, literally moving parts, you know. Tracking down Javier Guillen tomorrow will be a matter of, it'll be a question of sort of finding out when his plane lands and what part of Valladolid, when he's arriving at the press room, if he's coming to the press room, and so on and so forth. Slightly amateurish, you may say, but it is part of the fun of the fair.
Yeah.
I would also add.
I agree with that, certainly. And I think that's why I've got this kind of polarised view on it today. Having been on both sides of the fences, I just realised today how poorly served people watching on TV are with. I mean, you know, would it not be possible to get a statement from Guillen or from the head of the jury and, you know, stick it on the screen in all the different languages or whatever? I mean, these things are possible, but there's just no kind of thought process. It's just, you know, it just kind of unfolds the way it unfolds. And I think that's unsatisfactory. Anyway, we still have a race.
It also occurred to me, Lionel, that yesterday, in the story overnight, and we'll stick a pin in today's finish and we'll revisit this in a minute, but the story last night was about Remco Evenepoel not having received the instruction that there was a break down the road and altering his tactics, so he said, and we're going to hear that in a minute, altering his tactics for the sprint because he didn't have all of the information he needed. Now imagine, apparently that was because the fans were making too much noise. He couldn't hear an instruction that was clearly relayed by his director sportif. But imagine that had happened today. There's no reason why a similar breakdown in communication wouldn't have happened today, and that Remco thought he was racing to the original finish line, and that could have completely transfigured the Vuelta a España and the general classification. I said we would revisit that. Remco was in demand this morning, as he always is, in the mix zone. And we sort of demanded a bit more detail and a further explanation about just why he thought that not knowing there was no break down the road changed the way he approached the finale yesterday. So here's Remco this morning.
I would have especially changed my tactics in the last kilometer. I think I kept pushing just to keep some guys under pressure in the back. And if I would gamble a bit more for my sprint, I would definitely not try to take it on the lead and come from behind like I did in Andorra. So, but yeah, that's racing, that's sports. You make some tactical mistakes, and it was a pity that I didn't really know it. But new day and new chances.
Lionel, we had a suggestion from one of our loyal listeners, Moin Islam, on I think day 3 or day 4 of the world, so that we should introduce a daily feature, Remco's Rebuke. These were in the heady days of sort of Andorra and the day after, when the drama seems to be following Remco around, and unfortunately he often had a rebuke after the finish for someone, usually the race organisers. Things have calmed down in one sense for him, and as we heard earlier, he was pretty happy with the decisions made today. But could we make a case for another feature involving Remco, something along the lines of Remco's excuses? Is he making excuses? Yesterday about the lack of information about the break, today about his wheel sliding when Primoz Roglic dropped him.
I mean, unfortunately, you use the phrase all the fun of the fair, and I suppose this is where it gets slightly complicated, because information is key, isn't it? And conveying information from team car to riders, from riders to riders, is difficult when everyone's moving at 40 plus kilometers an hour. And that really is part of the nature of the sport. I mean, if you're unhappy about not getting information from the race radio or the earpiece radio because the crowd's too noisy, I mean, that's quite a strong argument to say, well, just do away with the radios then. And I'm sure if that was put to Remco, he would probably be on the side of no, let's keep the radio. So I mean, it's a moving circus, it's a chaotic race, riders not being aware of who's in brakes or whether riders are up the road. I mean, that is a scenario as old as the hills in cycling, isn't it? I mean, there've been riders who've crossed the line with their arms in the air, thinking that they've won, unaware that riders have been up the road. So I have a little less sympathy for him there. And in terms of, you know, making excuses, I wonder whether this is a consequence of him being such a hugely in demand figure, especially with the Belgian media, where, you know, there's so much coverage. It's all Remco-centric as well, I imagine. And having something to say every day is probably quite tricky. You know, he's in the spotlight an awful lot of the time, and he's at the centre of the action. And I think he's probably, you know, some of these excuses are almost decoy excuses, maybe. You know, give people something so that there's some red meat in the water for the Belgian media. I mean, that's speculation, but it wouldn't be a surprise. You know, give them something to feast on, and maybe that would then detract or deflect away from any sort of analysis of his actual performance.
Well, Lionel, whether that is or isn't the case, he has no need anymore to make any excuses today, because according to the commissaires and their magic eyes, he finished in the same time as Primoz Roglic over the revised...
So the results have been revised.
Invisible finish line.
Because earlier, there was a 2-second gap between Roglic and Evenepoel, so...
Yep, so according to the official communique.
Oh, I give up. Everyone gets a medal,
yeah,
and a certificate, and a copy of Vallata magazine, and they will go to Valladolid tonight.
Party bag to take to Valladolid. There was some nice cake in the press room. Maybe there's a slice of cake going into the party bags as well. Absolutely splendid. Lionel, we should, regardless of the shenanigans, just talk briefly about what we did see and whether. Well, I suppose. You can give me your opinion on whether Remco was indeed struggling. Jonas Vingegaard as well was having difficulty following Primoz Roglic's teammate. Sepkus also was clearly being dropped. Remco mentioned that it was particularly difficult for riders who climb out of the saddle. And we often hear this about gravel, uphill sections on gravel, don't we? Primoz Roglic, we know, I mean, he occasionally does get out of the saddle, but he has more of a propensity for attacking sitting down. We'd have to go back and look at the VAR to analyse whether people were sitting down or standing up on the upper ramps or on the steep ramps of that climb today. But what did you think that actually Roglic was in the process of turning the screw a bit on Remco?
I think he was, but I mean, it was a battle of just seconds, wasn't it? Well, in the end, it was a battle of no seconds, but so it's completely pointless what Roglic did in the end. But it's all part of this kind of phony war, isn't it? Roglic has ramped things up over the weekend, and you know, that's pretty ominous for, well, everyone. And of course, you know, still has Sepkus well ahead of. Well, Remco, I guess, is the first kind of real challenger to Sepkus's red jersey, and may well close that gap entirely in the time trial when the race resumes on Tuesday. But I think Roglic is doing what Roglic always does, which is just, like you say, turning the screw when he has the opportunity. And there really wasn't, well, nothing was gained today, but there were even before the sort of shenanigans with the results being revised, there probably wasn't going to be a lot to gain from just accelerating there, other than just getting into Evenepoel's head.
Yeah, it was interesting listening back to some of the interviews yesterday. Remco sort of alluded to the stress of having the three Jumbo-Visma riders around him, and I do wonder how much of that's going to be a factor over the coming days. You know, we know that he occasionally does react impulsively after the finish, and you know, whether that's going to cost him any physical energy, we don't know. But you can almost imagine that might become quite stressful if they're shadowing him for the next 2.5 weeks. And you know, in that light today, so there were two separate moments in the race when crosswinds did split things, and Jumbo-Visma were very much on the offensive then, and Evenepoel always did have teammates with him, fewer representatives than Jumbo-Visma, and they brought things back together. But there will be an attrition as well which comes to bear on his team, and if people think that his team has been significantly weaker than Jumbo-Visma in the first week, then the more attrition there is, obviously, the more that kind of gulf in quality, gulf in talent, gulf in pedigree, call it what you want, it's going to be accentuated, I think.
Yeah, which is why it was odd to see that Remco had a Soudal Quick-Step teammate. I think it must have been Cattaneo,
yeah,
doing some riding on the front. I mean, just let Jumbo-Visma get on with it. It's there. They're in the driving seat. I mean, Remco's surrounded by three wasps, but actually it's two wasps and a ladybird, I guess, because Sepkus is in the red jersey. And we see this all the time. Teams that are challenging sometimes help the team that's got the strength and the strength in numbers that Jumbo-Visma has. They don't need any assistance at all. Now, I know, obviously, you know, they'll be playing their own tactical card. Maybe they were trying to set him up for something. It didn't come to bear. But I would suggest sit tight, see how the time trial shakes down on Tuesday, and really treat the second half of the Vuelta almost as a sort of start again on Wednesday, once everybody knows what the time gaps are after Tuesday time trial. Because I suspect that could go pretty well for Evenepoel, even though we know Roglic and Vingegaard are both very good time trialists as well. But pan flat course, you would have to say, the pendulum swings towards the Belgium a bit, doesn't it?
Certainly does. Lionel, I propose that we talk more about the time trial in the final part of tonight's episode. Before we get to that, should we have, we'll call it nominally, we pick an interview every day to call the Encuentro del Día. And today's is with a member of Remco Evenepoel's Soudal Quick-Step support staff. He's the coach that's present here on the race, and his name is very difficult to pronounce, Lionel. His name is Vasily Antostopoulos, well known to some listeners, I think, as Mark Cavendish's coach when he was at what is now Soudal Quick-Step. I spoke to Vasi this morning about the sprint yesterday at Jerez de Cati, what went wrong, whether Remco would have won if he'd only known, and also the time trial and what we've got to come.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, Vasi, let's start with yesterday, shall we? And what Remco said at the finish line, he didn't know he was sprinting for the win. He obviously thought he could have won the stage. Is that a view that you share?
Yes, I definitely think that he could have gone for the win yesterday, the way he was riding. And we also saw that although the instructions from the DS, from the car, was clear that the brake is done and we go for the win. He didn't hear because of the people, I think, on the road. That's why he didn't understand. He didn't know that he was fighting for the win. And that's the reason that he was frustrated after the finish line, because I think he had the legs to go for the win and to take some more bonus seconds and a nice stage win, the second stage win to the Vuelta. But the good thing is that he's back. He felt really good on the last climb, although it's a climb that doesn't suit in the normally on his characteristics, with really steep gradients. So for us, that's the most important thing, that Remco is back to his good level again. After the crash he had and after the small virus he had in the team, I think now everything is gone, it's back to normal. So we're waiting. We're expecting to see a good Remco from now on.
Vasi, I'll ask you the same question I asked you a minute ago before we were recording. How would it have been different yesterday? How would the last couple of kilometres have been different if he had known yesterday?
I think the plan was to take the last right corner with 120 metres first, as apparently Roglic did. So if he knew, he wouldn't have let Roglic overtake him. And then he would just sprint all the way to the finish as he did the stage that he won. Either way, or even if he took Roglic's win, I think he was able to sprint for the last 10-15 metres. Because also in the images we saw that he was really comfortable behind him. He didn't even sprint. It was just a move to follow Roglic and just to finish the stage at the same time as him. So it was an unfortunate situation for him and for us, of course, losing a stage, but we still have a long way to go to Madrid.
Vasi, you spent a lot of time with Remco before the Giro at altitude. How different has his preparation for the Vuelta been from the preparation for the Giro?
I think we just followed the same philosophy. So he had some rest after the Giro, obviously because of the COVID situation. Then he did some small races. We did another altitude camp, a long one. Then he raced, here in Spain again. San Sebastian, he did some recons, all the important stages. Then again some time in altitude before the start of the Vuelta in Barcelona. And then here we are. So we just follow the same approach, as we did also with the rest of the team, who did two altitude camps before coming here, so in order to be ready to support him.
A similar workload, similar numbers of, I don't know, altitude gain? Yes.
Similar pattern. So we found a formula that works for Remco, and we just try to follow it and to do things that we know that will work for him.
And just last couple of things on the time trial on Tuesday. He talked couple of mornings ago about, well, the comparison with last year's time trial, the time he took out of Roglic last year, I think it was 40 seconds or something on a bit longer time trial. But it sounds as though he expects to take a decent amount of time on Roglic. What do you think, and particularly thinking about Vingegaard as well in the time trial that he did in the Tour de France?
Yeah, that would be a challenge, you know, because I don't think that we have seen Vingegaard against Remco in such a high competition race. You know, Remco is the world champion now. He knows that he needs to take some time on the TT. So if everything goes to plan, I think he can take some time. I cannot say now if it's going to be 30 or 40 seconds, but he can take some time, and especially this TT.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the vuelta.
This is El ritmo de la vuelta, in which we fandango across the Iberian Peninsula, the ruffles in our silk shirts flapping in the Levante winds like Movistar domestiques in the first hour of today's stage. Lionel, the year today is 1993. The song, the official song that is, of that year's edition was another one by Azul y Negro. You know them by now. They're from Cartagena in Murcia, where the stage started today. And they were sometimes referred to as Spain's answer to Kraftwerk. And as discussed in previous podcasts, named in honour of Italian football club Internazionale. This time the tune was Tu Par Car, and it was selected to celebrate a Vuelta a España, which both started and finished in Galicia in the extreme northwest of France. The race was the penultimate edition to take place in the springtime, the UCI having decided a few months before the 93 Vuelta that the 95 edition would kick off in September. The defending champ was Tony Rominger, and it would turn into a curious all-Swiss affair with Alex Zülle of Once taking the Maillot Amarillo in a 10-kilometer time trial on day one. Incidentally, 10 of 110 kilometers of time trialing in that Vuelta, and Rominger snapping at Zula's heels for the next 2 weeks. Finally, on day 14, Rominger dethroned Zülle by winning on the Alto de la Cruz de la Demanda in La Rioja Alta. Rominger won again a few days later on the Alto de Naranjo. By the time Zülle prevailed in the final day time trial from Padrón of Padrón Pepper fame to Santiago de
de Compostela, it was too little too late. Although not by much, Rominger's final margin of victory, just 28 seconds. Lionel, we've got a time trial coming on Tuesday, haven't we? After the rest day, and you're going to tell us a bit about it now, I think.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Lionel, you go first. You go first. We might get to gastronomic matters in a minute.
Okay, well, it's stage 10, of course, after the rest day. It's an individual time trial. It's 25.8 kilometres. It is in and around Valladolid, and there's a little rise at the start, but other than that, it's pretty flat. Wide roads, not overly technical. It's a sort of, not really figure of eight. I'm not sure what sort of shape that is, really. It looks sort of like a big Grand Prix motor racing circuit. It kind of weaves its way from one part of the city, quite technical at the start, but then it's sort of out and back with just a big hook-shaped loop at the bottom before the run into the finish. And as I say, mostly flat. The big question about this stage, Daniel, is whether Sepp Kuss will still be in red after it's all done and dusted. His lead over Marc Soler is 43 seconds. Lenny Martinez is at 102, and then Remco at 224. I've been looking back at Sepp Kuss and his time trial record, and of course he's pretty decent when there's an uphill style time trial. He was 14th in what was a pretty mountainous time trial at the Tour de France this year, 6th in the mountain time trial at the Giro, Daniel. At Rocamadour at the end of the Tour de France last year, he was 38th over 40 kilometres, losing 3 minutes 30 to his teammate Vingegaard. I suppose the time trial in recent years most closely resembles Tuesday's one is the Tour de France 2021 at Laval, 27.2 kilometres, pretty flat. And there he lost 1 minute 57 to Pogacar and 1:30 to Vingegaard. So he can pull out a reasonable time trial when he needs to. But I don't know. What do you think? You're frowning. Yeah, you're frowning.
Well, I was looking at his previous results as well. Obviously, it's really difficult to compare, well, like with unlike, because Sepp Kuss has the motivation of the red jersey. It's also, well, 10 days into a grand tour on Tuesday, which changes things as well. You mentioned previous performances by Kuss. The Giro, he lost 7 seconds, more or less 7 seconds a kilometre to Remco. The time trial on Tuesday, 25 kilometers, isn't it? So you can do the maths, because I can't. And I was just looking at Roglic versus Remco as well. He tends to lose. There are more precedents of Roglic versus Remco in a time trial. He tends to, or has tended to, the last couple of years, lose between 1.5 and 2 seconds a kilometer on flat time trials. I think Lionel Sepkus will probably keep the jersey after the time trial, but it will be close. I'm more interested to see Jonas Vingegaard and how close he can get to that very, very high bar that he set in the Tour de France with the final time trial there, because, well, they call it the race of truth. I think, you know, Vingegaard's performance so far has been a little bit confusing. There have been times when I've thought that he's been sort of zeroing in on Tour de France form, and then other occasions, today for example, when, with all the caveats we discussed before about the conditions, I did think that he was not looking his smoothest. But I think we'll probably find out on Tuesday a lot more. I think Roglic and Evenepoel are the GC riders who look best at the moment. And if Roglic can get under that to 1.5 seconds a kilometre lost to Evenepoel, I think that will bode very well for him, especially with the strength of his team. Lionel, should we hear from someone who knows a lot more about the course the riders are going to face on Tuesday, and also knows a lot more about how Sepp Kuss, Primoz Roglic, and Remco, not Remco Evenepoel, Jonas Vingegaard are feeling. That is the Jumbo-Visma Direct Sportive Mark Rafe. I spoke to him this morning in Cartagena.
I'm for sure that Remco, compared to, what is it, 2-3 days ago, that he's there again. And of course, it's not with one bad day that that he's not in the picture anymore. But yeah, also today we saw, but also the boys felt that that he is there again. And the pace was good enough. I mean, also with Sepp, he did also big numbers, but also the boys in the wheel did big numbers, because on the climb, yeah, in the wheel, you have to push the same as in the front. So pace was good enough, the situation was there. Primoz was also trusting on his sprint, and he could finish it off in the end. So in that way, we know that he was there, we know that he is there, and for sure, yeah, he remains our biggest opponent in the upcoming 2 weeks.
Mark, having Sepp in red, it obviously was a really nice problem, it's probably the wrong word to have, but it's a third thing you've got to think about. Does it make life almost a little bit more complicated in some ways that you've got a third card?
No, it just makes it more easy, I would say. It makes it more complicated for the rest, because they have now three guys where they have to pay attention to, and we have an extra card to play in the race. So in that way, it makes it more easy. In the race, the focus doesn't change. We still have to focus on the most focus on Primoz and Jonas, and he's just following the team in that way.
Do you think there's a world where Remco and Sudal Quickstep can ignore Sepp, and they can do their, you know, do the calculations and say, look at this guy's record in Grand Tours, 2.5 minutes, he's not going to win, or 2:50, he's not going to win this race, let's just focus on Roglic and Vingegaard? Do you think that's possible?
It would be a really good thing for us, and also for Sepp, because he showed all the last Grand Tours that he's within the best climbers of the bunch, stage after stage, day after day. The only thing is that he's now having almost 3 minutes ahead of the main competitors. And of course, there's still a TT to come where he will lose quite some time on Remco. But when he is still ahead of Remco, like with half a minute or a minute, and then I think that they will have a problem in the upcoming 2 weeks.
And just last thing, Mark, talking about the time trial, is there any sort of fear that Remco will obliterate this time trial? He has done it a few times this year, the first one in the Giro. And that he'll put a lot of time into Primoz particularly?
It's a possibility, yeah, for sure. I mean, you cannot compare this TT to the first one in the Giro, because it was on day one. We did 9 days of hard racing, so normally that will make a difference. But yeah, I mean, he showed his level, and also on the Worlds he was outstanding. And we know that he can make a gap on Primoz, but yeah, it's just and maybe also on Jonas, but also after that there's a lot to come, and then we get more into the part where we normally play a stronger role, what we've seen in the past. So it's still, he can take a lot of time, but the race is for sure not over, and there's a lot to come, and just one bad moment on one climb, what we've seen like 2 days ago, yeah, that will put everything upside down again.
I said last question. One more. Primoz is time trialing on the flat, in flat time trials. Maybe there's been a slight dip over the last few months. He hasn't won as many as he did in the past. How do you guys see it? Do you see him as on the same level as he's always been in flat time trials?
Yeah, for sure. You also have to look to the parcourses. Giro was flat, mainly two TTs. The last one, I think he was outstanding in the Giro, but he also won the TTs when it was a bit more on rolling terrain. Now it's a flat one. It's just that you have to deal with it, and you have to deal with a Remco who is for sure in the flat, and with his aero position, who's having a big advantage. And we see Primoz just how he was in the past, that he's not worse. He's even improving on his physics still. So he's still there. I mean, everything will depend on how the race will evolve in the upcoming days. What the time gaps are after the TT. We immediately have a mountain stage again. And then 13, 14 are going to show already how everybody is when the real mountains are coming. And also when you have real mountain stages. I mean, that are the first days that we are going to see that. And Sepp already showed this year on several occasions that he's then maybe even the best climber in the bunch. So yeah, I think that he's really having a shot on winning this Vuelta. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, Daniel, I've done the maths. If Sepkus does lose 7 seconds per kilometre to Remco Evenepoel, well, he'll lose practically 3 minutes, so he won't be in red on Tuesday night. So he's got to do a bit better. It will be close.
It'll be close.
And the red jersey will give him, you know, something. It's not. It's a totally different proposition, isn't it? He's riding in defence.
Is it as powerful as the yellow jersey? Does it give?
I don't know. Red's a strong colour, isn't it? Red is a strong colour. Didn't Bill Shankly say something about how playing in red gave Liverpool an edge? I mean, as an Arsenal supporter, you know all about this.
Particularly as against dark green stripes, dark green and white stripes, for example. Lionel, Mark Reef there said two very interesting things at the end of that interview. He said Sepkus might be the best ride. I think he said the best climber in the world or something along those lines. And also he can definitely win the Vuelta a España. Mm. I am sort of detecting little kind of nuggets. I mean, Remco talks so much and so well that you can't fail to pick things up in his interviews over the last week. But there's so much to conjure with at the moment with, as I said, this Vuelta a España so finely poised. It takes a magnifying glass sometimes, but I think we are starting to understand a little bit more about where these three big favourites for the general classification are. And I don't think they'll be as close, or sorry, four big favourites now. I don't think they'll be as closely matched a week from now once the Tourmalet stage is out of the way. Lionel, one thing we didn't really mention today is what a dreadful day of weather it's been in Spain. And for all our sort of hand-wringing about the confusion that reigned today after the finish and, you know, why Primoz Roglic got the same time as Remco Evenepoel and why indeed the last 2 kilometres had to be neutralised. We should point out that there have been all sorts of problems all over Spain today. Train lines being shut down completely. I read earlier that Almeida had warned the citizens of Madrid. And I wondered whether João Almeida was planning some incredible coup that would result in him winning the Vuelta a España by 3 hours when we get there in 2 weeks' time. But Almeida is actually the mayor of Madrid, and he was telling the citizens of Madrid that they had to stay at home today. So bad was the rain. A red weather warning. All sorts of other incidents reported all over Spain. In the province of Tarragona, where we were a few days ago, there was one town, Alcanar, where everyone again was told that they weren't allowed to leave their home. Shades of COVID. So bad was the weather there. We actually pretty well escaped down here in Murcia.
It does rather put my griping about my afternoon sporting entertainment being ruined. It does rather put that into perspective, doesn't it, really? So there are bigger things to be concerned about, aren't there? But Daniel, it sounds like your leisure centre there is getting quite noisy. Is it Sunday night badminton about to get underway?
No. Everything's been packed away, including the buffet that was raided by the participants in the Vuelta a España, which, Lionel, is probably my cue to, well, say goodnight to you, send goodnight to the listeners. No talk of yesterday's evening meal. It was pretty unremarkable, mainly because I'm preoccupied with tonight's evening meal. If I don't wind up this episode pretty soon, I'm not going to get one. So, Lionel, we'll be back on Tuesday.
We will.
I'm going to enjoy my rest day tomorrow.
And how are you getting there? It's a long way, isn't it?
We're driving. We've got an hour tonight and 5 hours tomorrow. Oof. But quite looking forward to it, actually. Big drive across the sort of open plains of Castilla-La Mancha and then the other side of Madrid towards Valladolid. So, Lionel, until Tuesday.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burnham.